Hello and welcome to my channel, Vice Rhino here. Today we're continuing on with part 2 of Bible Flockbox's Undeniable Proof of God video. But just one note before we begin, I did speed up the original video. I did this for several reasons, the main one being to cut down on time. I felt it was okay because he does talk fairly slowly and it is still comprehensible when I speed him up. So I'm sorry if you don't like it, but I still feel it's better this way, so that's the way I did it. And without further ado, let's jump right in.
Fact number 4. Humans have a sense of morality.
Okay, I'm gonna stop you right there. Whether you believe in absolute morality, objective morality, subjective morality, moral relativism, or any other variant of morality, we have excellent explanations for how morality develops in evolutionary terms. Essentially, for social species, it's more advantageous to behave in a way that we currently describe as moral, as that can assist with the survival of the species as a whole, and this includes selfless acts. Historically speaking, humans were very tribal. The people you spent the most time with were likely close relatives. Which means that historically, if you were willing to give your life to protect a loved one, that loved one probably shared a good amount of your genetic material, so protecting them ensured the survival of most of your genes, even if you don't survive yourself. Remember in part 1 where you pointed out just how little difference there is in genetic material between humans? That's exactly the explanation for selflessness. The genes that are selfless are more likely to survive because they promote their survival in other individuals. And while this does not demonstrate that morality is not tied to God, it does plausibly explain how morality could exist regardless of whether or not a God caused it to exist.
In every culture and every tradition in society, men and women have an intuitive sense of right and wrong.
Yes, and this sense can vary quite widely between cultures. There are cultures still around today, mostly in the East, that consider the welfare of the family as being paramount over the welfare of the individuals. They consider our individualistic view on life in the West to be selfish and immoral, while we look at their culture as oppressive and immoral. Jonathan Haidt goes into more detail about this in his book The Righteous Mind, which is an excellent read regardless of whether or not you agree with his conclusions. Back to cultural differences, there have been, and still are, cultures that consider the ownership of other human beings as property to be perfectly moral, and there are cultures that consider it morally abhorrent. You live in Poland, a country that does not allow slavery, so I would be willing to bet that you consider slavery to be immoral. Yet your holy book has guidelines about who you can take as slaves, who is a temporary slave and who is a permanent slave, how to sell your daughter into sex slavery, how much you can beat your slaves, and so on. These are things that most of us now find morally repugnant, but they were considered to be perfectly moral behaviors during the times and in the places that the Bible was written. So go ahead and tell me how we all have the same moral code that was written on our hearts by God, even though which morals God chooses to write on our hearts seems to change with the cultures.
The basic principles behind what Scripture calls the Ten Commandments, laws against murder, adultery, theft, dishonor to parents, and others, can be found in nearly every civilization on Earth.
Two things. Firstly, if they can be found in nearly every civilization, then they are not found in every civilization, which kinda cuts the God writes morals on people's hearts argument off at the knee. Secondly, the reason you only listed murder, adultery, theft, and dishonor to parents before stopping your list with the phrase "and others" is because the others, with the possible exception of bearing false witness, are not items that have been recognized as moral by very many societies. I don't recall there being very many other cultures that have the death penalty for working on the wrong day of the week, or that consider making graven images to be a crime, or just wanting stuff that someone else has, or not having other gods before Yahweh. Basically, at best, half of the Ten Commandments are things that could be said to have been considered immoral in most societies. The rest are very specific to societies that embrace the Judeo-Christian God.
Where does our sense of morality come from? Evolutionists don't have an adequate explanation for this, because if we evolve, that means that there are no moral absolutes.
Now, I am of the opinion that there are no moral absolutes. There are immoral acts that I think are impossible to justify regardless of the situation, but morals are relative to the situation. Is killing wrong? Yes, most times. But in self-defense, it is justifiable. Stealing? Same idea. Rape? That's one that I think is impossible to justify, though I could think of a very limited number of wildly unlikely hypothetical situations that could potentially partially justify it. For instance, someone kidnaps you and a second person, plants a bomb in a school auditorium, and says they will blow it up during an assembly if you don't rape the other person they kidnapped. Even then, I'm not sure if that would completely justify the rape, but my point is that situations can be imagined that could, if not justify, at least render understandable the commission of certain immoral acts. And even if it turns out that something like rape is a moral absolute, absolutely wrong in every possible scenario, that isn't because God made it so. That's because our evolved empathy kicks in, so most of us realize we wouldn't want to be raped, and so feel badly for those who have been, and want to punish those that do the raping.
Right and wrong are subjective, and whatever helps you or your species survive is the right thing to do.
And usually, what is good for the survival of the species would be the morally correct thing to do. Killing people? Not good for the species? Not moral. Stealing? If resources are scarce, stealing from a shared common pool could lead to that population potentially dying out, so not good for the species? Not moral. Sharing? Again, if you have a couple individuals hoarding the resources during hard times, that could cause the population to die out, so it's not good for the species. If they share, the population has a better chance of survival. So what's good for the species is good morally. Raping? That makes babies, so it must be good for the species, right? Nope. Raising kids with a partner is much easier than doing it alone, and raping is not very conducive to healthy relationships, so it's better for the species to propagate by consent, at least in a social species. Of course, this is not an exhaustive list, but you get the picture.
And you wouldn't feel bad, you wouldn't have a guilty conscience for doing things like stealing or murdering if you thought that ensured your survival.
And if my family were starving to death, I would not feel bad at all about stealing a loaf of bread to feed them. I probably would feel bad about killing someone who was trying to kill my family, but not nearly as bad as if I were to just let my family be killed. My point is that the guilty feeling that comes as a result of immoral actions is a direct result of the circumstances of those actions, meaning that morality is not absolute, it is situational.
However, we do have a guilty conscience when we do something wrong, and believers and non-believers alike both have at least some universal sense of morality, which, ironically, is based on many of the Ten Commandments.
Half at best.
So if this didn't evolve, where did it come from?
You're begging the question there. It did evolve.
The Bible tells us that it is God-given. He has written his law in our hearts. Psalm chapter 40 verse 8 says, I delight to do thy will, O my God. Yea, thy law is within my heart.
And as pointed out earlier, that's just not the case unless God changes which laws he writes on people's hearts depending on their cultures.
Fact number 5. There are similarities in the natural world. Have you noticed how nearly all creatures on Earth have similar physical features?
Yeah, it's almost as though the features developed in the past and then changed to specialize in different environments. Also interesting how if you group animals by shared characteristics, they fit into a nice little nested hierarchy where you can trace the development of the traits to common ancestors of the species that share those traits.
Mouths, noses, eyes, ears, and so much more. Evolutionists may try to say that's because we all evolved from similar life forms, but what if that's not the reason at all?
If that's not the reason, then that's not the reason. But all evidence points to that being the reason, so even if I grant you that there is a God, God still worked hard to make it look like we're all related. Also, there's the cases of convergent evolution. It's interesting how often species have different ways of doing the same thing, like, say, the difference between cephalopod eyes and mammalian eyes. Cephalopods have eyes that are essentially wired opposite ours. They look roughly the same, granted with weirder pupils, so the expectation with their similarities just being because of having the same designer would be that these different kinds of eyes would either not exist, or they would be scattered on a whim throughout different species. Had God made all land creatures with the same basic design for an eye as they have now, but given human beings a cephalopod-like eye, that would be pretty good indication that we were specially created. But stuff like that never happens. These character traits are all found in a perfect nested hierarchy. So if God did make everything similar just because it was his preferred style certainly makes it look like we evolved.
Fact number 6. The laws of nature demand a lawmaker. Scientists have identified numerous laws of nature that govern our lives. For example, a hot cup of tea will become cold if you don't drink it fast enough. Gravity remains steady, the speed of light is constant, and the Earth rotates in 24 hours.
Well, that was a big muddled mess. I could go on for hours just about how the Earth's rotation isn't a law and does change. But aside from the fact that these things don't necessarily need a thinking being to have made them as they are, let me just zero in on the speed of light bit. You said that the speed of light is constant. In that case, I would really like to know what your explanation is for the fact that we can see galaxies that are more than 13 billion light years away from us, meaning that the universe would have had to exist for at least 13 billion years for us to be able to observe them. Usually there are two creationist explanations for this that I have seen. The first is that when God stretched out the heavens, he sped up the speed of light so that the distant galaxies would be observable, which I assume you don't accept based on your statement that the speed of light is constant. The other is that God created the universe with the photons already in transit, which means that God went to an awful lot of trouble to make the universe look a lot older than it is, which seems very counterproductive if he wants us to take the Genesis account literally.
These laws are consistent. If any of them would change at any time, that could lead to a disaster. Imagine what would happen if gravity just decided to stop working. We would fly off the globe.
Yeah, that would be a disaster. But there is no evidence to suggest that such an occurrence is even possible, and no reason to believe that a god is needed to stop it from changing. Meanwhile, the Bible claims that God stopped the Earth from rotating for at least a full day, which is one of the laws that you have listed here as being unable to change without dire consequences to the people of the Earth. So it looks like, according to your worldview, these laws are malleable and could change at any moment, depending on the whim of your god. In a naturalistic worldview, there is nothing to indicate that any of these laws, at least the ones that are actually laws, even could change, and the ones that are not laws, like the rotation of the Earth, do change, but at a measurable rate, as in not suddenly stopping for 24 hours and then starting again.
Fact number 7. Many cultures have a flood myth.
And do you know what all these cultures have in common? They live in areas that flood. Most of the flood myths are so vastly different from the story of Noah's flood as to be obvious that they are independent creations, and the ones that share the most similarities, like the Epic of Gilgamesh, tend to be from the same geographic area, so they're likely based on one another. Besides, if you want to get into the idea that a certain mythological concept is true because of how prolific it is across cultures, then monotheism is clearly wrong, as it is in the minority. Most cultures historically have had pantheons of gods, not just a single god. Therefore, this must be accurate. There are multiple gods. If you don't accept my reasoning in drawing that conclusion, then you can understand why I don't accept your reasoning about how many flood myths mean that there must have been a global flood. And that's leaving aside the fact that floods are a common occurrence in many areas across the globe, so you would expect flood legends to grow in areas that see flooding.
Flood myths are common across a variety of cultures all over the world and are as old as the most ancient civilizations known to man. The oldest one is the Epic of Gilgamesh, which dates back nearly 5,000 years.
You keep bringing up points that debunk your own arguments. You admit that the Epic of Gilgamesh is the oldest known flood myth, and the usual rationale behind the many flood myths argument is that as the cultures got further away from the actual biblical flood, the stories changed, and that's why they're so different. But here you're admitting that the Epic of Gilgamesh is the earlier flood myth, which by that reasoning would mean that if there was an actual flood, the Epic of Gilgamesh tells the story more accurately than any of the other stories. All praise to the Sumerian god Enki for saving life on Earth by telling Utnapishtim about the coming flood.
In addition, there are over 200 flood myths around the world. And even though the details of these stories tend to differ at times, if a worldwide flood never happened, then why are there so many stories about it?
A better question would be that if a worldwide flood really did happen, why did so many societies live through it without seeming to notice it? Using the year given by Answers in Genesis, 2348 BCE, the Mesopotamian wars went on right through the flood. The 5th dynasty of Egypt ended 3 years after the flood when Pharaoh Unas died in 2345, which means that Pharaoh Unas would either have had to have been a maximum of 3 years old when he died, assuming his mother was pregnant with him on the ark, or he was on the ark himself as an adult, but then ruled over a kingdom with no people in it for a couple years until his death. Also, the Akkadian Empire started just 8 years after the flood, which would have to mean that in just 8 years, three women, four if you include Noah's wife, would have had to have enough children to sustain an empire, and a good chunk of them would somehow have to end up fully grown adults in 8 years. I could keep going, but we need to get through the rest of your video.
Fact number 8. Most calendars include a 7-day week. Have you ever wondered why the 7-day week is almost universally observed in the present world?
Not really, but off the top of my head, it seems like it would be tied to the lunar cycle, which is 28 days. Of all the numbers that divide evenly into 28, 7 is the one that works nicely for a work week. 4 days is too short, you don't really burn out after 3 days of work and need a day off. 14 is too long, 13 days of work in a row is very exhausting, trust me, I know, I've done it. 7 days work pretty well, most people could go 6 days working and 1 day off without too much difficulty, and yes, it does look like the ancient Jews may have been the first people to come up with a 7-day week that wasn't tied to the lunar cycles, but just because they organized their calendar in a way that stuck around before anyone else doesn't mean that their god exists. I mean, our current 7-day week, all the days are named after various gods, and the Judeo-Christian god doesn't get a single one of them. Is that evidence for all the gods that the days are named after? If not, then the fact that we use a 7-day week is also not evidence for your god.
what is it a measurement of? I mean, the 24-hour day is a measurement of how long it takes the Earth to make a full rotation on its axis. The year is a measurement of how long it takes the Earth to revolve around the Sun. And the month is an approximate interval between new moons.
All of the measurements are approximations, actually, not just the month. But why does the week need to be a measurement? Can't it simply be a way of having a day off on a regular basis that fits inside the 28-day lunar cycle? Even if it were completely arbitrary and had nothing to do with the lunar cycle, how does that equal evidence for God's existence? It's not like a 7-day week even fits nicely into our modern calendar. Most months have 4 weeks in them, but have extra days. Most people will tell you that a year has 52 weeks in it, but it's actually 52 weeks and one day, so it doesn't fit nicely there either. People chose this arbitrary number as a way of breaking up the work week, and that's the one that caught on. Therefore, God?
The 7-day weekly cycle goes all the way back to the beginning of Earth's history, when God created everything in 6 days and rested on the 7th day, instituting it as a holy day of rest for mankind.
On doing some cursory research into the history of the week, it turns out that the Babylonians were the first culture to institute a 7-day week, where they counted from the new moon, and the 7th, 14th, 21st, and 28th days were all holy days. It looks as though the Hebrews adapted their week from this tradition, but even laying that aside, if they were the first, all that says is that they based their week on their creation myth. Their creation myth happened to be 7 days, so their week also became 7 days. Had there been an extra day, it would have been an 8-day week. Had there been 1 day less, it would have been a 6-day week. There is nothing special about the week being 7 days. Although I will say that you are right, in as much as the fact that a week on the Gregorian calendar has 7 days is an undeniable fact.
Fact number 9. Some things could not have evolved.
You might want to word that differently. You see, if some things could not have evolved, the implication is that most things could have. Which I will point out again, for a Christian who accepts evolution, is not a problem. But when you claim that evolution is a fraud or a hoax, admitting that most things could have evolved once again undermines your argument. You keep doing that to yourself. It makes me wonder if deep down you don't harbor some secret doubts about the veracity of creationism.
The theory of evolution attempts to explain the origin of life apart from the intervention of God.
Impressive. Every word in that sentence was wrong.
Evolution doesn't attempt to explain the origin of life. It explains life's diversity. And it doesn't attempt to explain it apart from the intervention of God. It's just that none of the evidence points to the intervention of God.
But there are some major flaws with this theory. One of them is the fact that some living systems are so complex that they could not have evolved. The term for this is irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity means that you have to have all of the parts of a living organism in place in order for it to work properly.
I will grant you that it is much easier to look at a complex system with many intricate working parts and say, wow, I can't imagine how that could have evolved, rather than trying to find out how it evolved. But the evidence for evolution is so strong at this point that even if we did find something whose development we could not explain, this would just essentially mean that we need to work on understanding how it developed, not that it couldn't have developed. I mean, one of the most common creationist examples of irreducible complexity is the eye, and we know exactly how eyes evolved, so it's just a matter of study in most cases.
Otherwise, it just won't work. One example of this is the human eye.
You had to go there. Okay, let's see what you say before I get into it.
The human retina is so advanced that it is far more complex than any computer chip.
What is with you comparing biological systems to computer chips? Besides, even if I grant you that an eye is more complex than a computer chip, then remember, there are computer chips and digital cameras that do essentially the same job as our eyes, and in some ways they do it a lot better than our eyes can, and they are simpler, which, once again, points to God not being a terribly good designer.
Even Charles Darwin admitted in his book The Origin of Species, to suppose that the eye could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree.
And do you know why he said that? It's a rhetorical device. When presenting a case for something, it's common to present things from the opposite viewpoint at first as being understandable and reasonable, before explaining why it's actually wrong. This is a good method of winning people to your viewpoint, as it doesn't immediately raise their defenses because they don't see it as an attack on their position. But let's just find out what Darwin was talking about, so let's read the very next sentence, shall we? Yet reason tells me that if numerous gradations from a perfect and complex eye to one very imperfect and simple, each grade being useful to its possessor, can be shown to exist, if further the eye does vary ever so slightly and the variations be inherited, which is certainly the case, and if any variation or modification in the organ be ever useful to an animal under changing conditions of life, then the difficulty of believing that a perfect and complex eye could be formed by natural selection, though inseparable by our imagination, can hardly be considered real. He then goes on to point to other living organisms that have eyes in various stages of development. Creationists would do well to look at the context of the quotes that they mine. If somebody who is known to accept evolution says something that makes them look like they are against it, then you can be certain that that quote is out of context. Then, by using that quote as evidence against evolution, you do nothing but make yourself look rather foolish, especially in cases like this, where it's from a book that is so old as to be available for free as part of the public domain.
Your eye is so advanced that the back of your eyeball is about 1 square inch, but contains over 137 million light-sensitive cells. The skill that it takes to accomplish something like that would be like an electrician making 137 million electrical connections in 1 square inch. That's beyond the capabilities of man.
Really? It's beyond the capabilities of man? That's interesting, because the processor in my computer is an AMD Phenom 2 X6, which contains close to 1 billion transistors, 904 million to be exact. Each transistor has to have at least 3 electrical connections, so that's 2.7 billion electrical connections in my processor, which is just over a half a square inch. And on top of that, it's a few years old. New processors today have around 6 to 7 billion transistors. And if I'm honest, I'm not even sure where this argument is going, as something being beyond human capability is irrelevant when considering whether biology is designed or evolved. Honestly, when Darwin was alive, would you have been saying that flight couldn't have evolved because humans hadn't figured out flight yet? Okay, we have flight now. What does that mean for evolution? I'll tell you what. Nothing. Human capabilities are irrelevant to biological evolution.
Fact number 10, belief in God changes people's lives. Maybe one of the strongest proofs for the existence of God is the fact that belief in God has transformed countless lives throughout history.
Irrelevant. My life changed significantly for the better when I stopped believing, and I know several atheists who will say the same thing. Muslims say the same about Islam. Buddhists say the same about Buddhism. Hindus say the same about Hinduism. It's almost like changing your core beliefs will change your life, regardless of which beliefs you are changing from or which ones you are changing to.
Innumerable people have testified of how believing in God has helped them overcome destructive lifestyles and drug or alcohol addiction, how God has given them a purpose for living and hope for the future, and how God has helped them become more loving and kind. I can relate because God has drastically changed my life. I was a drug user and a drug dealer and started reading the Bible in jail after getting arrested for drug and gun crimes. While incarcerated, I accepted Jesus as my Lord and Savior and never went back to my old life of sin.
There are also a shit ton of people who aren't helped in the overcoming of their addictions by religion, and the religious mantra of just pray harder doesn't help, and when they relapse into their old addictions, they feel that something is wrong with them and that they aren't believing hard enough or something. If you have an addiction, seek science-based counseling. There are methods that help people break free of addiction without having to first call themselves powerless and rely on a higher power that there is no evidence for. If that worked for you, then great, congratulations, I am sincerely happy that it did. But it will not work for everyone, and that is a fact. To my audience, if anyone is struggling with an addiction, you are not powerless, as the traditional 12-step program would have you believe. You don't need a god to help you overcome your addiction. You may need help and support from friends and family, or professional support from a counselor, but that does not make you powerless. I'll leave some helpful addiction recovery links in the description, one for Canadian, one for Americans. If you're in another country, there are probably similar resources available, and a read-through of the American Addiction Center's page will help you know what to look for to get evidence-based treatment. But just know that help is available, and there is no shame in needing help. That's all for this video, and before I finish, I just want to gush for a little bit. I have recently passed the 20,000 subscriber mark, and while I didn't make as big a deal out of it as I did when I hit the 10K mark, this is a huge deal. You guys have been great, I really appreciate you all, I love all the comments I get, even, and sometimes especially, the corrections when I screw things up. You guys keep me honest and stop my head from getting too big, and also a huge thanks to all my Patreon patrons. You guys mean the world to me. The idea that someone would put out financially in order to hear what I want to say is just amazing to me. So thank you all so much for your support. It really does mean a lot to me. See you guys next time.